This is Intersection. I'm Matthew Petty. We're going to revisit a conversation with Orlando firefighter Jeff Orange about first responders and the risk of suicide. When Orange learned about the statistics on first responders taking their own lives, he said he was staggered. More first responders die by suicide than in the line of duty. Orange is a lieutenant paramedic with the Orlando Fire Department and the statewide peer team coordinator for the Florida Firefighter Safety and Health Collaborative. He says the peer support network represents a culture shift in the way first responders deal with the challenges of the job. And the next step in developing that peer support network is to have trained and vetted clinicians and peer supporters who are able to respond and help their fellow first responders during a traumatic event. Well, Jeff Orange, thanks for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
How long have you been running the peer support program?
Our peer support program through our Orlando Benevolent Association has been up and running for close to 5 years now. Mm-hmm. I've been involved in the state level through the Florida Firefighter Safety and Health Collaborative for about a year, assisting them a little bit longer, but in this official role for about a year.
Mm-hmm. And it was kind of a grassroots thing, right? It grew out of, you saw a need for this kind of thing. It happened organically. It wasn't like this was a directive from your management team.
Correct. We stumbled upon it. We saw the numbers, which were staggering, and we saw that suicides kept outpacing line of duty deaths. We decided that we didn't want to wait for a directive to come out, and we wanted to see what we could do to get ahead of it.
Mm-hmm.
Through that, the members really kind of took this on, and they were the ones who really propelled this thing forward by just taking care of each other.
How hard is it to get data on what that problem is like, firefighters taking their own lives because of, you know, the trauma they've experienced?
There's not a lot of hard data on it. There's one group who's out there, a gentleman named Jeff Dill. He does a lot of the reporting, but that's very grassroots. A lot of this goes underreported,
mm-hmm.
Either because of the stigma attached to it. The family doesn't want people to know. They're afraid of what this would do, even in some religious standings. So a lot of this stuff goes very underreported, and nobody's mandated to report it
mm-hmm.
either. So it can be very hard to find solid numbers on what the suicide rate is.
Was it kind of like a eureka moment when you thought this is what we have to do now, or did it sort of build up over time, like the genesis of this program?
Yeah, it was, like I said, it was surprising to see how many people were actually struggling, but the scope of what the problem was developed over a time.
Mm-hmm.
We almost had opened Pandora's box and given people an outlet to reach out. And then once that started happening, the magnitude of this really started hitting us in the face.
So tell me about the kind of learning process and what you have to do to teach your fellow firefighters the steps to go through to get help and how to help support each other.
Yeah, there's some programs out there that really do a good job of helping us navigate difficult conversations. That's the trickiest part about it. You have somebody that you're emotionally invested in who's in a crisis, and now you have to talk them through and help them get to that higher level of care. Speaking with them can be a very tricky thing. So there's some programs out there. A very good program is right here in our backyard, which we utilize often. It's called UCF React Training.
Mm-hmm.
And that really teaches us how to navigate those difficult conversations. But we also have to know what resources to look for, what people to send our members to so that they're getting the proper help, not just any help. That's part of the learning process as well.
And how does it kind of fit in with the directions you might be getting from senior leaders? Like, is there a bit of a learning process for them as well?
Yeah, I think anytime that you're dealing with something that you can't see, you can see a broken arm, so you know that somebody's in need. But you can't always see that mental injury. When you can't see it, it's hard to wrap your head around if you've never been through it as well. So the education process is not just for the peer supporters. It has to be for the senior leadership. They have to grasp onto it. The the HR personnel have to understand that they have a program out there that's trying to bolster and really trying to beef up what it is that the city would offer, what it is that the municipality would offer, and that the byproduct of all of this is that you're going to have a healthier workforce who's then in turn going to be able to help the citizens. So you're going to have a healthier customer by making your workforce healthier.
Mm-hmm.
You're going to have longevity. You're going to have less sick days. You're going to have a lot less financial obligation by providing these things up front.
Has there been buy-in?
The buy-in is coming. I think it depends on who you're talking about as far as buying in.
Mm-hmm.
We were fortunate that we had buy-in from the members, the boots on the ground, before we had buy-in from anybody else. And that's the most important person to get buy-in from. Because if you have a member who realizes that there's a need for it, and they're able to look out for that member that's sitting right next to them, that buy-in is crucial. So we were fortunate to get that buy-in pretty early on.
Mm-hmm. Jeff Orange, is there a bit of a culture shift underway then with first responders? Because I wonder if part of the reason that it might be difficult to have these conversations is it's partly kind of a instinct for self-protection. You know, you're seeing and dealing with terrible things all the time. You've got to find a way to deal with that, and it might not be the easiest thing in the world to kind of get those feelings out in the open and talk about the stuff that you have to deal with.
Yeah, there's definitely still a stigma attached to reaching out for help. I'm ever the optimist, so I believe that the stigma really has decreased, and we've seen it decrease in our department now throughout the state of Florida, as well as more people are stepping up and saying, I had a problem, this is how I navigated it, and I'm healthier than I've ever been. That adds validity. And so that person who's going through that problem now has an avenue now to reach out. And they have that trusted coworker who is going through or has gone through the same thing. They no longer feel isolated. They no longer feel like they're one out of a thousand. They no longer feel like a black sheep. A lot of the reason why people don't reach out in our profession is because you have to be called to do whatever the task is at any moment's notice. And if you feel that you don't have the trust of your crew members, then you're not going to reach out.
Mm-hmm.
But as the crew members start to realize, hey, you know, even if somebody is in a bad spot, it's our job to help them out of a bad spot. We don't want to push them down any further. We want to help them out. And so people are starting to realize that my career is not going to be affected. My standing with my crew is not going to be affected. That's typically the first thing that people will say when they reach out, or that they used to say, is, I don't want my crew to find out. And will this impact my career negatively?
Mm-hmm.
And we're starting to find that the more people who reach out for help and then speak out after they've gotten help, we've really broken down a lot of those walls.
Are they also worried a little bit about letting down the people they work with every day?
I think they're worried that the perception of the people they work with will be altered,
mm-hmm,
because of what they're going through. There's things that are acceptable, and then there's things that we perceive as unacceptable. It's acceptable to get very angry. Anger is a very accepted emotion. It's not acceptable to cry. It's acceptable to drink excessively. It's not acceptable to see a clinician or a therapist because you don't want to drink excessively.
Mm-hmm.
Those things are really starting to shift. We're really seeing a shift, and it's amazing to watch. I think that we're only going to go forward from here.
What are some of your biggest success stories so far?
I think on a very personal level, those are the success stories. We've had multiple people go through who think, for instance, there's one gentleman who was ready to leave. He didn't care about his pension. He didn't care about his paycheck. he was just going to move out of the state. He thought, if I can move as far away as possible, I'll leave a lot of these demons behind. Well, fortunately, he reached out for help. He went to UCF Restores, which is a clinic right here in Orlando, and he got the help. He's back on the fire trucks. He says healthier than he was before he left, and now he's also a part of our peer support team. Mm-hmm. So that's a huge, huge win, and he's one of our senior members, so he's still perceived in that status.
Mm-hmm. So you've also got a new partnership, I understand, with UCF, right? Can you tell me a little bit about what's going on there?
Yeah, so the Florida Firefighter Safety and Health Collaborative has come up with a program called Redline Rescue. And one of our members, just an amazing person named Dustin Hawkins, came up with this idea to connect peers with peers. So if you have a trained peer supporter who meets a demographic that a peer is really looking to reach out to, then they can through this app. It connects everybody throughout the state of Florida, as well as connecting a member who may be in crisis with a clinician who also meets the criteria that person's looking for.
Mm-hmm.
We just partnered with UCF to help us get Redline Rescue up and launched. An amazing, amazing accomplishment. We're hoping to have Redline Rescue up and running sometime this year, hopefully within the fall, maybe a little bit later than that, just working out the logistics.
Mm-hmm.
But the collaborative and UCF and the amazing thing that they've done, it just is a natural partnership.
How does it actually work? Are there some sort of people monitoring it who can make those connections? Like, how does this app actually function?
Yeah, so once you are a vetted peer, you meet the criteria to be a peer who can be placed into the system. That's what happens. You're placed into the system. And then from there, it will give the location that you're at. So let's say that somebody is, lives in an area that is not necessarily where they work.
Mm-hmm.
What they can do is they can say, I need to talk to somebody. They can pull up the app. And this app will match them with who it is that they're looking for, that vetted peer. And then they'll be able to reach out to that peer and from there make contact. Same thing with the clinicians. If they live in an area and they're not sure what clinicians would best serve them, they could type in what it is that they're looking for. Maybe in a peer they want to look for somebody who matches their demographics. Maybe they want to look for somebody who's married, has two kids, has 23 years in the service. You know, well, then I would match that criteria for that person looking for it.
Mm-hmm.
And the same thing with clinicians. So UCF is really helping us get over that hump as far as funding and building out the rest of this algorithm so that we can match. It's almost like a dating app.
Mm-hmm.
For peers looking for peers and peers looking for counselors. It's very similar in the regards to looking for who's going to best suit you, and so that you don't have to jump from person to person to person to person.
So either way, I mean, people are familiar with the sort of notion of how it should work. So it should be fairly easy for people to get their heads around how to use it.
Yes, exactly. Exactly. Mm-hmm. The goal is to make this as user-friendly as possible. What we found is that the more hurdles that you place in front of a firefighter and the help that they need to get to, the less likely they are to get to that help.
We're heading into the high season for hurricane season. Last year, of course, Hurricane Michael devastated the Panhandle. I'm sure that had a big impact on first responders, not just in that area, but everybody who had to go there and help out. Do you kind of worry about what firefighters are going through as the hurricane season becomes more busy?
Yeah, there's obviously for the people who are affected in their area, so the Panhandle, for instance, Hurricane Michael, these people had to respond in their own cities and see the devastation caused, all while being away from their home and not sure what's happening at their house. Some of the things that we saw in the aftermath were the clinicians that they had before maybe didn't have anything to come home to, so they packed up and left. A lot of the resources that these people would typically have now gone. And that's just the aspect of the people who live in the area that are affected. We have task force that goes to these areas that are affected. And those people are in charge of search and recovery. Mm-hmm. They're in charge of post-disaster management. Those people are affected as well.
Mm-hmm. In the aftermath of a big event like this, do you now also have people whose job it is to tend to the psychological well-being of first responders? Like, is that part of the sort of SWAT team, if you will, who goes into disaster situations?
Yeah, that's definitely something that we're trying to build right now, and we're making amazing progress on it into our statewide emergency response plan, is to have trained and vetted clinicians and as well as peer supporters respond with these task forces so that anything that they might be encountering, we can really try to stay ahead of.
Mm-hmm.
So that is being built into the statewide emergency plan, statewide emergency response plan, and hopefully we'll see some real progress.
What would you like to see happen next as you work on the rollout of your task force and the work that you're doing with the peer support collaborative?
I would love to see the conversation shift, and I do believe that it has, shift from whether there's a need for it to we know that this is real. We know that it's affecting our members. We can see the negative effects of it, even in the shortened lifespan of first responders compared to the normal citizen, or the average citizen, I should say. And shift from that conversation to let's start building resiliency. Let's start providing education. Let's do this early and often. Let's give our responders positive coping mechanisms. Let's have them prepared before the incident ever happens. Teach them how to navigate those difficult conversations with family members when they get home. How do you have a conversation with your wife after you get home from a terrible shift and have her understand that, or convey to her that, no, you're not blowing her off or shrugging her off or anything like that. You just don't know how to speak about it yet.
Mm-hmm.
So giving the people the skills to navigate that, education. That's what I would love to see.
Well, Jeff Orange, Lieutenant Paramedic and Statewide Team Coordinator for Florida Firefighter Safety and Health Collaborative, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
And that interview first aired on Intersection last July. Up next, what do social media companies do with all that data they've got from you? And how sophisticated does a phishing email have to be to work? We'll have a conversation about the promises and pitfalls of our increasingly connected world. Intersection's back in a minute. This is Intersection. I'm Matthew Petty. Dr. Jan Solehin is the director of UCF's Cybersecurity and Privacy Cluster. That's a department in the College of Engineering and Computer Science that's growing along with the growth and awareness for the need for better cybersecurity. Last July, I sat down with Solehin to talk about some of the challenges his group is wrestling with and what the future of cybersecurity could look like. Solehin's research is focused on the interface between hardware and software. I began by asking him about advances in hardware and software design.
In fact, for the last few decades, hardware progressed a lot faster than software. So we essentially were able to double the number of transistors. Essentially, transistor is a electrical switch.
Mm-hmm.
We doubled the number of transistors every 18 months until just a few years ago when it started to slow down a little bit.
There's actually a formula for that, right?
Yeah, it's called Moore's Law. It's not an actual law, but it's a prediction. And for some reason, the semiconductor industry has been really good at, essentially tracking that prediction for decades. So mm-hmm. that was very impressive.
But your focus is on cybersecurity and the kind of interface between the hardware and the software.
Right.
And as far as cybersecurity goes, it seems to me that it's been in the news more lately. I mean, there's been news about phishing attacks, from presidential candidate Hillary Clinton's email hacks to hacks on healthcare groups like Family Physicians Group here in Orlando. Back us up a little bit and tell us what a phishing attack is and how that sort of plays into what you do in your research.
Yeah, so phishing attack essentially typically starts with an email. Someone essentially pretending to be someone else that the receiver may be fooled into thinking that. So let's say I may receive an email from someone pretending to be my bank, let's say BBNT, and ask me for account verification. And then if I click on the link, I enter my information, my password, and so on, it turns out it's not BBNT, but it's someone else pretending to be BBNT, and they get a hold of my information. So it's very prevalent now.
Is this kind of like a low-tech hack, like a simple thing, do you think? Because it's more about somebody getting fooled by what they think is something real when it's not. Like, how high-tech is that?
It has been low-tech, but it exploits like a psychological weakness of people. And, you know, sometimes we are just busy.
Mm-hmm.
We don't pay attention too much to a single email. And, yeah, it's low-tech, but it's increasingly becoming high-tech. There is something called spear phishing, in which the attacker utilizes essentially very personal information. And let's say they mine it through, let's say, social media or through other means. They can pretend to be your uncle, and they can sound like your uncle and so on. Yeah. Hmm.
So they're using, like, voice-changing technology and that kind of thing to try and make you think that you're speaking to somebody that you know.
Yeah, that's within their capability these days, So they could. But they could, you know, like, use a simpler technology, say, you know, they know your, let's say your uncle is just finished traveling somewhere, and they mine it from the, let's say, Facebook account. And then they can, you know, they can include that trip, and then it makes you, it fools you into thinking that's the real uncle. Yeah.
And is that something where we can expect to see more of those kind of high tech, you know, uses of technology to try and trick people into thinking something is something that it's not? Or what about, for example, deep fakes and things like that, where they're able to kind of construct a pretty convincing video of somebody or an audio recording of somebody that actually isn't them, but it sounds pretty close to the real thing?
Yeah, in fact, that is extremely concerning. And I think, you know, the technology is only getting better, where they can generate, you know, fake video of somebody else. And that's actually very high-tech, because they use a 3D model synthesized from many photos, and then they also synthesize a voice based on you know, recording, and they use artificial intelligence to do that. So it's very concerning, and it's going to be applied not for phishing, but also for misinformation, and, you know, for interfering with the election, or, you know, public opinion to sway it in one way or another.
How much of what your department does focuses on some of those kind of bigger, more philosophical kind of questions of, like, you know, swaying an election? That's a pretty big deal, right? Do you sort of look into some of the how and the wherefore of those things and try to figure out ways to get around that?
Yeah, so we focus mostly on the nuts and bolts of how these attacks happen. So, I mean, so for example, there is a machine learning group here that looks into deepfakes, and, you know, from our point of view, so we want to, you know, some of our research wants to add trustworthiness to information source. So, for example, if we see a video or image, can we at least certify, you know, essentially certify the audit information about that image? Let's say this image was taken on the following date, using the following camera, at the following altitude, and stuff like that.
So you'd put like a watermark on it to say this is kosher, this is genuine.
Yeah. So we add metadata to to this data, such that the metadata can say something about the data in a cryptographic way. So it cannot be tampered by attackers without being detected.
You're listening to Intersection on 90.7 News. I'm talking to Dr. Jan Solahin. He is the Director of Cybersecurity and Privacy Cluster at UCF. What about things like ransomware attacks? Are you seeing more of those as well?
Yeah, ransomware, I think the technology behind it has been around because essentially it's just encrypting your files. But recently, because there is cryptocurrency, there is a mechanism for an attacker to demand a ransom without revealing their identity. So then it took off like a few years ago, you know, became a lot more prevalent now because of that payment mechanism. Yeah, it's certainly a problem, especially for, you know, organizations that have low IT budget. And, for example, there was a ransomware attack not long ago with the city of Baltimore. And, you know, they were struggling with their budget and they, you know, like they spent only half of the IT budget compared to other cities. And that means they're going to overlook some obvious things that, you know, IT department has to do. And that's dangerous, essentially, with ransomware.
That'll be a lot of pressure on a city's IT department thinking that they could get hit with one of these attacks, right? Because that would be pretty devastating for a city. I mean, I can't imagine, you know, what that would do to, say, the city of Orlando if this city got hit with a ransomware attack.
Yeah, so the attacker, essentially, with ransomware, they get a hold of your system, you know, let's say initially through phishing. And then once they get a hold of the, your system, it generates a random key and then uses that random key to encrypt your files. So your files don't disappear. You know, they're not deleted. They are there. But they have been encrypted such that you cannot see the content anymore. And, you know, I think it's very troubling. Essentially makes people panic, right? So... And then the next step for the attacker is to demand for ransom, and they essentially say, "Give us some payment, and then we will decrypt your file so that you can access it again." And that payment is typically through cryptocurrency because it's convenient and you know preserves anonymity.
It's not just a concern for like a city or a health organization, right? There is also people's personal information that can get ensnared in some of these ransomware attacks, right? I mean, that, and that's got to be a worry for individuals. Like, what if my social security number gets lost in an attack, or you know, what if people get a hold of other sensitive information that I don't want getting out there? So, what's the kind of key to making people feel more secure about all that information of theirs that's out there and that is vulnerable to hacking and attacks?
Unfortunately, I don't have a good answer to that. It's pretty you know, it's pretty troubling. But you know, I think there are kind of like good practices that can reduce the risk of getting this kind of security attacks, right? So, you know, there is something called cyber hygiene, which is essentially ensuring that employees don't fall into phishing attack easily. So they constant training is needed. And at UCF, for example, we have the IT team kind of like design their own phishing email for simulating an attack.
And they try it out in real time?
Yeah, they try it in real time. And then they figure out, you know, which people kind of fall into that and what is the rate of the success and so on. So, and then they can... you know, target some people for retraining or that kind of thing. So that I think is very useful.
What about some of the bigger kind of global security implications of cybersecurity and some of the research that your cluster does? Like, what direction are we heading in there, and how big a part of, you know, interactions between different countries is cybersecurity going to be in the future, do you think?
Well, I think, unfortunately, cybersecurity is, I think, being weaponized. It will become, you know, involved more and more in cyber warfare. And it has some kind of desirable features. You know, there's, you know, nobody dies from it, right? Or maybe this. But it can essentially gives a warning to the adversary, hey, we have this capability and we can really disrupt and make your life really difficult.
And there are real consequences to some of those intrusions, right? I mean, say if a malign agent got into somebody's energy system and were able to shut down nuclear reactors or something, that would be pretty disastrous, right?
You're absolutely right. So increasingly, in the past, computer systems are just computer systems, right? They don't interact too much with the physical world. But increasingly, it's become the case that they are intertwined with the physical world. Yeah. So I think the U.S. government, for example, has been concerned with the electrical grid security.
Mm-hmm.
There is a talk, for example, for an inverter use in a solar farm.
Mm-hmm.
And it turns out that there is a concern about the supply chain of that inverter supply, you know, manufactured by potentially untrusted facility.
Mm-hmm.
And if enough of these are involved and they can essentially send wrong information to the grid, and then the grid can essentially has a cascading failure.
Mm-hmm.
And that affects a lot of people. But at the smaller scale, even let's say pacemaker,
mm-hmm.
This is being being made smarter by connecting it to the internet, right, with TCP/IP.
Mm-hmm.
And that brings a new kind of like vulnerability in which, you know, someone can mess up with a pacemaker and then cause a harm to individuals. I mean, there are a lot of vulnerabilities. So, for example, operating system, typically the operating system developer release patches.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, a good practice is to immediately apply the new patch, right?
Mm-hmm. But because we're human, we don't always do that.
Right, exactly. So there are a lot of places in which the patch has been released for more than a year and the operating system still has not been updated. So that's extremely vulnerable. And attackers know that, but they don't always exploit that because, you know, maybe there are some lower hanging fruit somewhere else.
What keeps you up at night?
I think the scariest thing to me is the Internet of Things. Mm-hmm. So with the cloud, you know, I think there are some, you know, if we put our data in the cloud, it's relatively okay, relatively safe. There are some attacks that can be done in the cloud, but at the Internet of Things level, essentially we are augmented our life. You know, we have smart light bulbs, smart toaster, smart, mm-hmm. you know, refrigerator, and, you know, smart watch, and so on. This is all being developed in a rush. You know, there is no incentive for manufacturers to follow the best practices in security because, you know, they want it to go out to the market as soon as possible.
Mm-hmm.
And the product is expected to be cheap. And because of that, then there are not many eyeballs, you know, so they don't have a large development team. There are not many eyeballs looking at, you know, the code, making sure there are no vulnerabilities.
Mm-hmm.
So I think this is just accident waiting to happen. So there are a lot of examples of that. So there was a Fisher-Price, a teddy bear toy,
mm-hmm.
with a camera on the nose. There was release a few years ago, and it turns out that it's vulnerable to hacking. So, attacker can, in theory, they can essentially bypass the, get a hold of this system and then activate the video camera, and then record everything that that happens in the house or in the child, right? Interaction with the child.
Yeah, which is pretty troubling for a parent.
Right. Right. But there was also more intentional or semi-malicious one, which is, let's say, baby doll,
mm-hmm.
called My Friend Kayla. That was released recently. And so it turns out that this company produced this My Friend Kayla. It can talk with the child. It can record the child and then send the conversation to the cloud for processing, and then it will give an intelligent response and stuff like that.
Mm-hmm.
But in the cloud, it turns out they are running a transcription software and transcribes that conversation between the doll and the child.
Mm-hmm.
And they are selling that transcription with a third-party company. So there's essentially there's a value to data. So data is valuable. They're selling it. Mm-hmm. And because the law has not caught up with that, so they were able to do that.
So your advice might be maybe think twice before buying that cool new toy which has some kind of fancy internet-connected capability.
Yeah, exactly. So that's my concern. A lot of people, I mean, they try to be, you know, when it comes to their, let's say, computers, right, physical computers, Wi-Fi router, they know how to, you know, they know that they should use encryption, they use, you know, firewall and stuff like that. But when it comes to toys, they overlook all these vulnerabilities.
Well, Dr. Jan Salihin is the Director of Cybersecurity and Privacy Cluster at University of... And that interview first aired last July. Still to come, before Fred Rogers was a children's television icon, he was a music student at Rollins College. The college is offering a guided tour of the campus beginning this weekend to coincide with the release of the movie A Beautiful Day in the Neighbourhood starring Tom Hanks. We'll take that Mr. Rogers walking tour of Rollins College when we return. This is Intersection. I'm Matthew Petty. Before he became a star of children's television, Fred Rogers' neighbourhood was the campus of Rollins College. The college launched a walking tour of the Winter Park campus last year, the 50th anniversary of Mr. Rogers' neighbourhood, and the tour is returning this weekend to coincide with the opening of the Tom Hanks movie A Beautiful Day in the Neighbourhood. We begin the self-guided tour with Museum Visitor Services Associate Taylor Morris at the Cornell Fine Arts Museum.
First, I let them know why we're having a tour. Some people don't know that he went to school here, that he studied music here, that he actually met his wife here. And then I'll hand them a map and a sticker, which is always exciting, and then point them towards his sneakers and sweater.
So let me ask you this. Have you had a lot of people coming through and seeking out the museum because they know this is the start of the tour and they're particularly interested in that?
Yeah, definitely. A lot of people are interested, especially now that there's a movie being filmed soon about him. I think they're wanting to learn more.
Communications manager Joe Marie Hebler picks up the tour.
I came up with the Mr. Rogers tour because everyone was wondering what we were doing for the 50th anniversary of the show. And so I said, we at least have to get the sweater out of the archives and bring it so the public can come and see it. And so here it is at the Cornell Fine Arts Museum. You can see the blue sweater is made by his mother. And there's another one at the Smithsonian in Washington, D.C. that is red. But he gifted this to Rollins when he returned here for his 40th class reunion. And he gifted us the sweater and the sneakers. And he wrote on the side of the sneakers that these were made to make a lot of episodes of Mr. Rogers' Neighborhood, and he signed them Fred Rogers, class of 51.
The sweater especially, but also the sneakers, kind of became a signature for him, right? Is that something he kind of grew into, or was it something that was part of his look from the get-go?
Right from the beginning, he wanted children to feel at home and at ease. And so he would walk into the set and immediately take off his suit jacket, take off his tie, put on the sweater that his mother made him, one of the many which were in the closet, and he had them in many colors. He took off his dress shoes and he put on his sneakers.
And the sweater, his mother crafted that?
Yes, she made sweaters for her entire family. Her nephew has told me to the amount of one per month, so everyone in the family had many, but Fred particularly liked the ones with a zipper, so she always made him one with the zipper. And on the TV show, he would go up and then down a little and then up a little. You know, he always did the same thing, so it's pretty special that we have this.
A short walk across the campus is the music department.
This is stop two. This is the music building and the John Tiki Concert Hall. And we call this the Fred Rogers Lobby because it has our most famous alumnus, a big portrait here of him that was painted by Don Sondag, a local artist.
What are some of the features that people pay attention to in this portrait?
First of all, he's smiling, which Mr. Rogers always did, and I think the picture really captures his gentle personality. And the other thing is the sweater and the sneakers. Again, the sweater with the zipper, it happens to be a red one. And those famous sneakers, and he's putting them on. And
it looks pretty lifelike, doesn't it?
Yes, it definitely does. He has that twinkle in his eye, and just we love having this here. And everybody loves seeing it. They don't get tired of coming in here.
And tell me about his connection to Rollins. What was it that brought Fred Rogers down to study at Rollins College?
Well, he was quite a musician and a composer, and he was going to Dartmouth, and it wasn't fulfilling his musical needs. And actually, the professor that came to Dartmouth to teach music that was going to set up a program up there told him he should look at Rollins. So he came down here, and he fell in love with it. Again, he met his wife here and lots of friends. People liked him instantly, and he had a large group of friends. He was in a fraternity. He was very popular here.
How long after he graduated from Rollins did he find success with his show?
Well, immediately after he left Rollins, he told his parents that he was going to make television better. And to do that, he actually started in Canada. He started his first children's program there. It wasn't called Mr. Rogers' Neighborhood, but he started it there for several years. And then when he returned to the United States, then he started Mr. Rogers' Neighborhood and the first episodes 50 years ago.
And he wasn't afraid to tackle tough and tricky subjects that you might not have found in children's television up until he came on the scene, right?
Exactly. 50 years ago, for him to talk about he had a kitten who gave birth on the television, that was, you know, that was really earth-shattering at the time. He talked about divorce, and that's what kids needed to hear and see, and they were captivated by that. The other thing about him is the speed of his voice. They said it was, for a lot of us adults that are always in a hurry, he seemed slow. But for children to grasp that and for their brain development, the rate of speed that he spoke at was just right.
Mr. Rogers also, you know, in times of strife in the United States, he's a person that people hearken back to and say, look, here's an example of who we need to be looking to in times like this. I'm wondering what your sense of, you know, the need for a character like Mr. Rogers and his importance, his legacy beyond the run of his television program.
Well, in fact, our president of Rollins, Grant Cornwell, just wrote a letter to the editor. It was published in the Orlando Sentinel, the My Word column. And he said, you know, the world really needs Mr. Rogers now more than ever. And he really lamented the fact that in Washington, nobody can get along and everybody's fighting. And when Mr. Rogers went before the Senate and asked for, you know, millions of dollars to keep public television going, he really won him over with just his gentle demeanor and not being aggressive or demanding. So there's definitely a place for that. And unfortunately, people think today the louder you are, the more you'll be heard. But Mr. Rogers really proved that by being gentle and kind-hearted that people listen.
As a thunderstorm sweeps across the campus, we skip the Walk of Fame and head for the library.
Okay, so this is stop four. We're at the Olin Library, and a lot of these items are usually kept in our archives, but we are open to bringing them out for anyone who requests and visits, and we'd be happy to do that at any time. But we have Mr. Rogers' yearbooks.
He was part of fraternity when he was at Rollins?
Yes, Alpha Phi Lambda fraternity. And his dormitory was Lyman Hall, and that's where his stone on the Walk of Fame is outside of Lyman Hall.
Tell me about the letter that's on display here.
So Mr. Rogers, on his signature paper with the little red trolley, he would leave people around here notes all the time after he visited, because he would come back during the winters with his wife and stay for a month or so. And everyone would get a little letter that knew him with the little trolley, and this was one of those letters, and it said, "Dear Rita, thank you again for all your many kindnesses to us this past weekend. What a thoughtful person you are." He was just, you can here are the kindnesses that we avoid these days. And he says, here's the sweater I promised for the archives. And he also left the sneakers, too. And then there's pictures in here of when he returned and visited our child development center, because naturally that's one place that he would gravitate to be with children and talk to them and visit. And for many years, and in fact this year too, Rollins College did a sweater drive in his honor on his birthday, March 20th, and collected sweaters and donated them to homeless causes.
There's quite a bit happening this year around the 50th anniversary of the television program. One of the things you've got here in the display cabinet is an image of a stamp. Tell me about that stamp.
On March 23rd, the Mr. Rogers stamp, postage stamp, comes out. And here at Rollins, we've been very excited about it for a very long time. And in fact, our post office had pre-order forms that we could pre-order these stamps so that we could have them. So I'm sure if you get anything from Rollins with a stamp on it, which is unusual these days, but it'll have a Mr. Rogers stamp on it.
And it's an image of Mr. Rogers wearing his signature sweater, and it looks like a puppet he's holding there.
Yeah, that's King Friday. That's one of the puppets. He was the voice of all the puppets.
Music was a pretty important part of his life at Rollins, and it carried on into his television show. Tell me about the couple of examples you've got here in the display cabinet.
Well, we have songs from the neighborhood, the music of Mr. Rogers, and there's several famous people that performed on them. Amy Grant is one, Maureen McGovern, Roberta Flack, some names that some of us older people might remember. But the songs, he composed all of them himself. In fact, I think there were about 200 or more songs that he composed himself. And It's a Beautiful Day in the Neighborhood, of course, is a signature one. And It's You I Like is another one that I know that his nephew who works here, that's his favorite song. But he was quite a musician, had quite an ear for music, and in fact, Dr. John Sinclair, the head of our music department, would run his compositions by Fred Rogers, and he would be able to pick out ways it could be improved.
And the last stop of the tour, in front of an engraved plaque near Strong Hall.
So, for a long time, people thought that the life is for service. Because Mr. Rogers did use that a lot, he would say, life is for service. He had a plaque on his desk in his office. He had it in his home. And people thought that we had it at Rollins because he said it, when in fact, he saw it at Rollins, and he kept an etching of this sign in his wallet for the rest of his life. So it really inspired him, and he would touch it when he passed by, and a lot of people are inspired by it now because they know what it meant to him.
So tell me about what inspired you to start this walking tour.
Well, first of all, I have four children who loved Mr. Rogers, and I loved him as much as they did. I would take the time out to sit and watch the episodes with him because he calmed me down too, being a mother of four and, you know, things being hectic as they are. So it was... it was really therapy for me as well. So I really adored the man. I sure did. So coming to Rollins and then working in marketing and communications, the media was calling and saying, what are you doing for Mr. Rogers' 50th? And so I said, well, we at least need to get the sweater and sneakers and put them on display. And then as I talked to people and I thought about all the different memorabilia we have here that Mr. Rogers touched or gave to us or that inspired him or inspired us, I said, this could really be a tour. And that's how it all came about. And I think it's been really well received by everybody. Everybody's excited.
And that was Jo Marie Hebler of Rollins College talking about the Mr. Rogers tour of the Winter Park campus. That interview first aired on Intersection in March last year. Support for Intersection comes from Advent Health and from our listeners. Intersection's producer is Brendan Byrne. Our intern is Elizabeth Gondar. Subscribe to the podcast on iTunes, Google Play, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts. We're more than halfway to our $350,000 goal in the fall silent drive. Your support is what keeps local programs like Intersection on the air. If you've already made a contribution, thanks. If not, please consider a gift of support in any amount. $10, $20 or even $50 a month helps support our local reporting and the programs from NPR like Morning Edition and All Things Considered. Call 1-800-785-2020 or wmfe.org/support. I'm Matthew Petty. Thanks for listening.